This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Back in the 1970s, the city of Cincinnati was hoping to revitalize its urban center. And from that effort, Queens Gate 2 was born. And its community gathering point would be the town center, connecting to Music Hall next door by Skywalk. It would have an amphitheater and even an old large clock from Union Terminal. But it didn't work out the way planners had hoped. Demolition crews knocked down the town center, the centerpiece of the city of Cincinnati's urban renewal project known as Queens Gate 2, late last year. The project was designed in the late 70s to be a star attraction in Cincinnati's attempt at revitalizing its urban center. It even promised to host artists and singers with a cheap way to perform for audiences in its park-like amphitheater in the round.
You could put a quarter in and you got 25 minutes of limelight. So you could do anything you want with it. So people would come, put their quarter in, and sit in the middle of the amphitheater. Maybe no one else was around, play the guitar. It's kind of cool.
That's right. Deposit one quarter and get 25 minutes of limelight. Jack Dominic was general manager of WCET-TV, whose studios are adjacent to the town center, back when the project went up. The site was funded by a generous contribution from the Corbett Foundation, but it met its end after never realizing its promised potential, according to Dominic.
So the concept was to aggregate the arts. The arts were spread out, all as they are now, the various offices. So they figured if you could put them in a central location, there could be a lot of synergy, a lot of cooperation, etc.
But it was clear almost from the beginning, the town center with its rounded towers, its skywalk to Music Hall, and its centralized amphitheater would never meet expectations.
So over the years, sadly, it just fell apart. In fact, the first winter, they forgot to turn the water off. There were restrooms and dressing rooms over there. They froze. And of course, water was all over the place, and they were never repaired. That was the first year.
The water severely damaged the impressive sound system installed to assist performers, and it forced the closure of the public restrooms immediately. They never reopened. And finger-pointing over who should take care of it quickly followed. Again, here is Jack Dominic.
So all of a sudden, you've got this facility, and it's dedicated, and everybody, you know, rah, rah, isn't this nice, kind of cool. But then, for the next 15 years, nobody at the city took responsibility for it. Is it a park? No. So the park's, it's not ours. It's a parking garage? Oh, we'll take care of the parking garage, but we don't do amphitheaters. Nobody found it in their portfolio.
So Dominic and others from WCET took it upon themselves to maintain the town center, keeping the planters lively and the site presentable. In fact, when WCET hosted PBS's national convention in Cincinnati back in the late 70s, the town center saw its most vibrant night, according to Dominic.
The place never looked so good because luckily we had good weather. It was warm that night. I do remember that. But we had an outdoor dinner for probably 750 people at white tablecloths, et cetera, set in the amphitheater, et cetera. It was really quite nice and was probably one of the few times that the place actually did what people had hoped it would do.
What people had hoped for was a revitalization of the city's urban core following years of white flight and decay. Cincinnati City Councilman David Mann, who first served at City Hall during this era, remembers the effort.
People were feeling fear about crime. We were still not very successful at living together, black and white, rich and poor. There was fear about schools. There was this exodus driven by a lot of things, including federal subsidies for mortgages and interstate highways and so forth. And so it's always easy to build buildings, and we learned it's more complicated.
So complicated, apparently, that the rest of the ambitious project, which called for residences, an office tower, and shopping atop the adjacent parking garage, was abandoned, Dominic said.
Well, the rest of the development really didn't happen, as you can see. We don't have an office tower. We don't have apartments. We don't have a bazaar on the third level of the parking garage, which was supposed to be retail and shops and coffee shops and all these boutique things, which on paper, looks wonderful. Well, the neighborhood hadn't changed yet.
But now the neighborhood has changed. Over the Rhine is flourishing with redevelopment to the east of the former town center, and directly to the west, FC Cincinnati is building its new Major League Soccer stadium. The old town center is becoming a parking lot. What may happen after that is not yet known, but Councilman David Mann has some ideas.
It'll probably be replaced with something along the lines that we see in other parts of the Central Business District and OTR, where there are vacant lots, and that is parking, retail, and other commercial opportunities, and housing. People want to live in the city. They want to live in or near downtown. That's very exciting.
Jack Dominick hopes the optimistic rise and forced fall of the town center serves as a learning opportunity.
Hopefully, you know, it's a lesson. It was a great experiment. It's a shame it didn't continue.
And now joining me live in the studio to talk about Queensgate 2, the town center, and urban renewal in general are Cincinnati Public Radio's social media coordinator, Ronnie Salerno, who wrote extensively on this project at Queens City Discovery. Ronnie, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have with us the principals of Yard & Company, a Cincinnati-based development firm, Joe Nickel. Joe, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having us.
And Kevin Wright. Kevin, thank you for coming back on.
Glad to be here.
And we want to hear from you, too. What are your thoughts or memories of the old skywalk from the WCET building and the garage here over to Music Hall? What do you think about urban renewal in Cincinnati in general? You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. We've already got a couple of comments that we'll share a little bit later. Ronnie, you and I spent some time walking around what they called the town center portion of Queensgate 2 not that long ago, a few months ago, and it looked like a really missed opportunity. It wasn't a bad space. Why didn't it work out in your estimation?
It was a really, really, really cool space. And compared to like suburban amphitheaters and that you see in parks being built now, it had the lights that you talked about in the piece, and it's got all these features that were there. I think ultimately the reason it didn't work out was there just wasn't much going on. The planned development didn't come. The West End had kind of been decimated by the highway going through. There's not a lot of residents around. So if you want to go have a performance there or you want to go enjoy it, you're not really near anything. There's no chance for anyone to really walk by and discover it. And being nestled next to a parking garage and with the ramp coming down around, you couldn't really see it. It was kind of hidden and kind of protected from the street.
I want to emphasize that point about the limelight because it was such a cool feature. There was just a tall light post out there that you could put a quarter in and the light would come on. It would shine directly on the center of this round stage that was on the street level. And then there would be seats around it that elevated upwards from there. And you and I tested like the acoustics in the very center were really astonishing.
Yeah, it was, and we just kind of discovered that by accident, walking around and having a conversation. And if you stood right in the middle, I mean, you could hear yourself anywhere. And there were lights up on the bridge. There were lights actually built into the ground. And yeah, I mean, it was a pretty big, pretty unique production.
A few years ago, you wrote a piece at Queen City Discovery titled Music Hall's Bridge and the Neighborhood That Never Was. So we know about the bridge, the skywalk that connected the parking garage to Music Hall, which has also since been raised. But what was the neighborhood that never was?
So Kenyon Bar, which was a Cincinnati neighborhood that it all kind of stems from the 1948 master plan. Kenyon Bar was raised and redeveloped into what's now called the Queensgate neighborhood. Very industrial. The idea was to bring jobs in. The highway was put through. So then the next phase was to turn the West End into Queensgate 2. So Queensgate 2 is the idea of the neighborhood that never was. Really original name, just calling it Queensgate 2. What we've seen out in front of our building and what was originally planned, that was kind of supposed to be the start of it along with more development. And it was really kind of mismanaged, wasn't moving very quickly and ultimately never happened. And the West End remained how it is today.
You note that we are right next to where this was. And I should also emphasize that I interviewed Jack Dominick, the former GM of WCET, which is downstairs in WVXU, and Cincinnati Public Radio leases its space here in this building from CET-TV. And so we got to hear the demolition a lot last fall and over the early part of the winter while it was being torn down. I want to reintroduce our other guests who are joining us here in the studio, Kevin Wright and Joe Nickel from the Cincinnati-based development firm Yard & Company. I wanted to bring you guys on because you specialize in planning and helping cities make the best of their spaces, particularly as it relates to public use. This looks like it was a project that wanted to attract public use. It never did. Based on any reading that you've done ahead of our interview here, or any knowledge you have in general about similar projects, Joe or Kevin, what do you think was wrong with this?
Well, I think when you look at projects like these, and you know, really, it wasn't alone nationally. Cities all across the country after World War II were responding to a variety of forces that they, you know, wanted to fix. And really what it stems from was a misunderstanding of what kind of problem the city presented. Prior to World War II and all the kind of military might that we developed for it, the cities were built out of the social life that they created, the economic life they created, and the artistry of bringing those two together. For some reason, after World War II, it became an engineering problem, and it became a federally funded problem, a very top-down response to the state that our cities were in. And so it shifted to be something that we could just fix overnight. And when you look at how these projects were delivered, they were just that. They were delivered. Overnight, seemingly, a massive amount of change was brought to a district within a city. And what happens, ultimately happens with any project like that, is nobody falls in love with them. There aren't enough Jack Dominicks in the world to keep them running. There's only one in this case. And, you know, Jane Jacobs, for your listeners who probably know who Jane Jacobs is, she had a great phrase that describes this. There weren't enough eyeballs on the space. Where it would not feel safe to be there when the light wasn't turned on, when someone hadn't deposited a quarter. Although I think your listeners are probably realizing they missed a great opportunity to see Michael Monks perform in that space. So, you know, this idea that you just deliver a project and expect it to be loved, that's not how neighborhoods and places are made. They're made by the incremental changes that happen over a long period of time where people get to feel like they're part of it. And the Queensgate 1 and Queensgate 2 – that was never part of the program.
And Joe, just for our listeners' sake, those of us who don't know who Jane Jacobs is, would you mind telling us?
Yeah. So Jane Jacobs was actually one of our country's first responders to this urban renewal movement, starting in New York City. And she was a journalist, and she and a bunch of residents rallied together when a plan was being developed to bisect Manhattan with a major thoroughfare, and that would raise her neighborhood very much in line with how Queensgate was envisioned. And so she got together and really started to analyze what makes social life and social spaces and public spaces special and neighborhoods special. And she went on to write a number of great books, Death and Life of Great American Cities being chief among them, in kind of response to this urban renewal movement. And she's become an amazing figure in people that are trying to put cities back together.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. We'll also take your comments on Facebook or Twitter. We got a comment from Kimberly Faust on our Facebook page as it relates to this topic. She said, quote, "I miss the skywalk to the back entrance of Music Hall. Its removal had impacts for older concert patrons. It was a safe, convenient way to get to the garage. As a volunteer for the CSO, the Cincinnati Symphony, I had my regular spot on the top level. I could see my car from the back door of Music Hall. When the skywalk came down, so ended our relationship with the CSO. We also got a comment from Laura Lawson on Facebook. She said, quote, "I remember that place. I used to see it and what inhabited that spot as we'd come back from concerts to our parking spot. Sad to see the way it looks now." And again, I am joined here on Cincinnati Edition today by Joe Nickel and Kevin Wright of Yard & Company, and also Cincinnati Public Radio social media coordinator Ronnie Salerno, who has written extensively on urban issues, particularly as it relates to Queensgate 2 at Queen City Discovery. Kevin, let me bring you into the conversation, because we're at a point in the region's urban centers where cities are trying to maybe remedy mistakes that were made from a planning perspective in the middle of the 20th century, or even more recently than that. I'm wondering if you could share some examples of how some local communities are responding to some, I guess, perceived planning errors from the past and ways that they could be successful moving forward.
Well, first, thanks for having us. I think there are a number of examples. I kind of sticking with the Facebook commenters comment about the skywalk, you know, and tagging on to what Joe said, the post-World War II approach to our neighborhoods and cities was frankly to lift everything away from the street, right? And to get people to not have to walk on the street, to not have to walk through the neighborhood. In Ronnie's blog post, there was a quote that said something along the lines of, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, this will always be a poor neighborhood.
We talked about that quote just this morning, Ronnie.
Yeah, that was the Queensgate 2 development manager, James Twitty.
And was he the city manager, or was he involved in the city government, or was he just brought on? Do you remember?
I don't believe he was the city manager. Gotcha. I think he was just overseeing the project. But it's a pretty blunt quote to give to the press.
Yeah, absolutely. yeah, exactly. And it's a sign of the times of that era that he would so openly say that. You know, to dig into that mindset really was that middle income or upper income people will never want to live here for sure. But they won't even walk on the sidewalks. And so that led to sinking the amphitheater down into the ground, lifting up the skywalk, and a number of other mistakes on the design side, which, you know, kills any chance for a safe street, both from criminal activity and also from pedestrian safety and automobiles. And it also kills any chance of on-street retail, and probably did destroy many on-street retailers that existed at the time. It also gave an excuse to continue to develop auto-oriented streets and think of the city and neighborhoods as pass-throughs, through places, not to places. And so I think, and then even going back to your piece with Jack, you mentioned the neighborhood hadn't been fixed. Which I'm not sure what that meant. It could mean a variety of things. But yeah, of course it hadn't been fixed. You lifted everyone off the street. And so I think, to your question, in 2020, what are we trying to do to remedy this? I think as an industry, a planning and development industry, we're getting better at embracing incremental change, community-driven change. An example that we've worked on was over in Newport, Kentucky last fall, where we built 7,000 square feet of linear bike lanes, bike infrastructure, coming off of the Purple People Bridge with neighborhood residents to take back the street to make it safer. I think when you get more people involved who are of the neighborhood and from the neighborhood and they're getting their hands dirty, building something, they're involved in the design process, it's much easier to get people to come and put a quarter in a machine and dance, right? But if it's done for you by someone else, that tends to lead to spaces that are not used and not loved and, you know, where there are no memories made by people who live there.
And so we understand that professional planners like you guys who are in the field and working with governments who may also understand to a certain degree what the trends are and what good land use might look like. Is there any disconnect between that sect, the professional planning side and the government side, and the public? So when you talk about bike lanes, for example, Kevin, is there pushback from the public that says, well, what do we need these for? We're having a hard enough time finding parking as it is, or cyclists don't belong on the streets and that sort of thing. And how are you able to facilitate those conversations?
Well, the beauty of that the answer to that question is really a wonderful answer, is that this incremental temporary testing of ideas, which we're starting to see more, many folks refer to that as tactical urbanism. We talk about it in terms of demand discovery. You know, if people show up and they don't like it, if no one rides their bikes on the bike lanes, if City Hall gets a lot of complaints about traffic or parking, that then informs the permanent design. So we can, you know, it's a real-time engagement tool that doesn't ask people to come to another meeting, but asks them to experience their streets in a different way to inform the permanent design, as opposed to a Queensgate type project that is designed by people from out of town, with multi-millions dollar budgets. And once the concrete's laid, it doesn't move, as we've seen. And in this case, in your story, I thought it was really interesting that there wasn't even a real idea around who was responsible for the different aspects of the space. And the bathrooms got flooded day one and never got fixed. And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like from the offset, Ronnie, this appears to have just been kind of a failure, although it was completed in terms of the town center itself. Well, maybe not with the shopping components and all that, but the amphitheater was somewhat functional and never used. I'm holding in my hand a brochure from the mid-1970s promoting some type of public forum about the forthcoming Queensgate Town Center. Phase one, they note, was already under construction with the outdoor theater and the fountains and the gazebo, skating rink, sitting areas, community television studio, which of course we are sitting above right now. CET is still there. But phase two is what never really materialized, Ronnie. That's where they start talking about a structural deck over the garage with all the utilities built in will provide a fully improved sight in the air with built-in parking and public transit. These drawings illustrate a dramatic focus for 15,000 families in the surrounding community. How different would this part of town be had this come to fruition, do you think?
Well, I think the biggest change is it'd be a lot more active. And, I mean, one of the plans called for a new Greyhound station. And Avco looked at moving their world headquarters there. They're previously north of the city. And there's also plans for a department store. So now you've got shopping. You've got the resources people use. If there's Greyhound connections, then you have to have other transit connections. I think it would have been a lot more lively, or at least that's how it was envisioned to be. But even some of the more bold things, like talking about the skating rink and all these activities and programming, you know, like you were just talking about, Kevin, no one really maintained it from day one. So how, if these ideas are there, who's actually going to program them and make it happen? And I think like a lot of what you see at Fountain Square now, where people come down during the holidays or they're even out there just on the weekends, no matter what the weather's like, I think that's kind of what was envisioned for this little corner of the city. Just no one really saw it through.
And I'm also holding now an old article from a 1982 edition of the Cincinnati Enquirer written by Jane Merkel, who was billed as the Enquirer architecture critic. So that shows you the era of newspapers that we still had where you had that type of beat. But the headline was simply Queensgate 2, a partial success. So even 5 years into this thing, it seemed that locals were conceding that this was not going to look the way that the original planners had intended. Yeah. So let me toss it back over to you, Kevin and Joe from Yard and Company, and give us some examples of what communities are doing, I guess, to redefine what their urban centers look like. I know there was a trend around this time to suburbanize the urban core in some respects. There were more parking spaces created, commercial properties that were set farther back from the street. Are communities in our area starting to recognize that that may not have been great planning and they're trying to fix that?
Well, I actually want to answer that question by piggybacking on you and Ronnie's last bit there about what would happen if it had been built. And the reality is in places within the Midwest, those types of projects were built. And so we can actually go and see them and how they're functioning today in kind of real life. So in Pittsburgh, around the same time that Queensgate 2 is being envisioned, a project called Allegheny Center was built. And it did all the same things that were envisioned in this document. And fast forward to within the last 10 years, it was an empty hulk of a place because it was built on a very different set of fundamentals than the traditional urban form that make all of our cities great. It wasn't until the last couple of years when an amazing tour de force of economic activity was able to remake that space into something that's worth spending time in. Hulking office buildings were remade into kind of places for living in. The mall was reshaped around experiences of shopping that are more relevant today than they were in the department store area, that kind of thing. But that's a rare occasion where enough energy was able to be applied in one of these urban renewal projects to actually save it from itself. What is happening in most cases is what we're seeing around here is that those projects are being imploded and brought down to the ground. And the responses are widely varied to just turning it into a parking garage or a parking lot or leaving it fallow to turning it into some semblance of an urban neighborhood, you know, walkable streets, reconnect the street grid, you know, doors and windows facing the street where people live, retail and other services within walking distance. That has typified probably more widely speaking, the response to these kinds of projects.
So if you were advising the city, and I've got about 15 seconds. We know there's a parking lot going in there now, but if they get the opportunity to bring something in, what do you think would be a catalytic development outside there? You can say these things. Ronnie and I cannot.
Well, with the history of development happening to the West End from the top down, I would, in my 8 seconds I have left, say that whatever happens, there should be smart, active community engagement with the folks who live as close to it as possible to make sure that we don't end up with a space that no one wants to use or be a part of.
Kevin Wright and Joe Nickel from Yard & Company and Ronnie Salerno from right here inside this building. Thanks to all of you for being on today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having us back.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Marks.